Morning, good afternoon to everyone on today's PPSC PDP call on Thursday the 4th of February. We have Jeff Newman, Alex Gakuru, James Bladel, Tatiana Kramsova. From staff we have Glenda Sangeri, Marika Konings, Liz Gaster, Margie Milam and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. And we have apologies from Wolf-Ulrich Knorben. I hope I haven't forgotten anyone on the call. And please, if I could just remind you to state your names when speaking. Over to you, Jeff.
Okay, thanks. It looks like Paul Diaz has joined at least Adobe. Paul, are you on the call as well?
He's just joined the call as well, yes.
Yes, okay. Hello, everyone.
All right, good morning, good afternoon. It's Thursday, February 4th, 2010, and this is the weekly call of the PDP team. It seems like we have a smaller than usual turnout on this call. I'm not sure why that is. But that being said, we do have some people on. Just to recap where we are and then the agenda for today's call, we on the last call had pretty much finished up most of stage, if not all of stage four document, which is up on Adobe right now for those of you that are looking. And then we have issued the survey out for stage five, which we'll begin discussions on today. Marika, have you gotten any responses to, I know James said he has responded. Has there been anyone else that has responded?
Yeah, this is Marika. So far, Avery, Brian, James, Bertrand, Alex, and Wolf Ulrich have submitted responses.
Okay, good.
So it's still lower than the usual feedback, but I think people still have a couple of days to provide their input.
Yes, I think the plan was to go over some of those results next week. So I think, yeah, for those of you that have not done it, including myself, we'll have to get it done in the next couple of days so that we can get some results out by Monday, by early next week. That said, we're also, I know some of you actually joined the call early, we were talking about logistics for Nairobi. It turns out I probably or most definitely will be going to the Nairobi meeting, and so it seems like we'll have pretty much the full work team, at least the people that participate, most often we'll have representatives from each of the stakeholder groups there. We'll also be setting up some remote participation. We've had to kind of juggle around some meetings. It seems like there's some new TLD discussions that may be going on, and there are still some other meetings that are being finalized, so we're going to have to be playing with the schedule. But it did seem like people that were going to be in Nairobi will be there, on Friday or at least by late Friday night, so that if we had to move some meetings till Saturday afternoon, we could, depending on Kurt and new GTLD discussions. The last thing we want to do is really conflict with those meetings, because I think we'll have very few people attend if that's the case. So with that being said, I think is there any questions on logistics? I think the next we'll have a call this week. We'll have a call the following next week, and so we'll continue to have some weekly calls until just before the meeting starts. Any other questions?
Jeff, this is James. Am I correct? We still have three calls before the meeting. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm just looking at the calendar as I was saying that. So we have a call the 12th. We have a call the 19th.
No, the 11th, Friday. Sorry. 18th, and 25th.
Okay, thank you.
Now, I personally may not be able to make the call on the 25th. As I'll be traveling, but I'm hoping either someone from policy staff or someone else could kind of step up and help at least chair that individual meeting. But yeah, so we have technically three calls before the we will not meet on the 4th since people will be traveling most likely on that date to get to Nairobi.
Right. So we have three calls plus this one.
Correct.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, any other questions on logistics? All right, so I know, Marika, you have stage four up there, but I think other than the timelines, which are in the last question, I believe we've covered everything we can. I'm sorry, I still need to draft that letter to the board, the board governance committee. I'd gotten just some feedback earlier this week from the GNSO council chairs that they are, they believe the GNSO council will be fine with just sending the letter directly from the work team to the board governance committee, so that hopefully there will not be any political issues, at least according to the chairs. They seem comfortable with that. Is that, Marika, that's your understanding as well?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, well, so at least the chairs are comfortable, so we'll follow that guidance, and of course if others on the council aren't comfortable with it, you know, I'm sure we'll find out after the fact, but at least by then the letter will have gone out to the board. So I still need to draft that, do a first draft and send that around for everyone. So other than those issues and the timing overarching issue, Marika, I believe we are ready to go on to stage five.
This is Marika. I think we, you know, I mean, they might be covered by what we already discussed, but we didn't specifically address, I think, 6C and 6D. I presume the answers follow similar lines, but 6D relates more to, you know, if the implementation has gone ahead, but the council actually feels that it doesn't meet the policy recommendations, while, you know, as staff went ahead, probably did feel it was in line, what options does the council have to address that or challenge that? And the 6D relates to, you know, can an implementation process change recommendations? For example, if the recommendations are deemed not implementable. And, I mean, that might relate back to the question that, you know, staff will need to come back and verify it with the council. But maybe the 6C question needs a bit further discussion.
Yeah, so I think on the last call we talked about the notion, and it's reflected in the notes, of having an implementation review team or something. I can't remember if that's exactly what we called it. Yes, that's what we did. So that should be consulted if there's, or, you know, so the council will be watching what's going on, and then we had recommended the creation of this implementation review team to be consulted or tasked by the GNSO should questions arise. Let's do that. Let's throw those last two questions out to see, to make sure we've answered it. So 6C, as Marika said, is should. You know, the staff is obviously tasked with creating the implementation plan, although we did talk about, and we are recommending that the working group will or could recommend in its report to the council, and then obviously to the council report to the board, could recommend certain things, certain implementation mechanisms, and so that could give guidance to staff. Keeping that in mind, We had then said that if there's questions that arise that look towards, that are getting towards policy, that the council itself or the council could create a team or an ad hoc group that could review the implementation. So the question is, should there be a procedure for the council to object to certain parts or the whole implementation plan if deemed not in line with the recommendations? James, you have a comment?
Yeah, and well, it's more of a question, I think. I'm just trying to understand the difference between, let's say, an active versus passive involvement of the council in the implementation. So a passive one would be where the, you know, some part of policy implementation where staff would bring that to council or to the IRT. You know, the information review team, versus a time maybe where staff thinks that they're going okay, but council wants to reinsert themselves back in the process. So I'm just trying to figure out, are we addressing both of the active and passive scenarios in this question, or is there some distinction that I'm not getting? Or
no, I think we're kind of addressing both. I'm not sure which approach the council will want to take. I think it's probably dependent on the issue, right? But I think this question is meant to address both.
Yeah.
So we started out with the question of, should the role of ICANN staff in developing the implementation of the approved policy be further defined, and if yes, how? That was the initial question. And then if we go review the notes, we all suggested a mechanism should be developed by which that if there is a number of different options, that the staff should come back to the council or working group for some advice, right, consistent with the recommendation.
Right.
And then, so I guess that was, it's more of a, I'm thinking about your question. I guess the council role is more passive at this point as opposed to active, in that really it's staff's job to come up with the implementation, and the council's really more of an oversight advisory type role.
But do you foresee any situation, Jeff, where the council might unilaterally want to reengage staff on the way it's implementing a policy? I mean, I'm trying to be as open-minded as possible, I guess.
So in the abstract, and then I'll go to Marika, in the abstract, it could be a whole different, a bunch of different ways, right? Because I could foresee situations where the working group could specify, if it wished, how they would like to see it implemented.
Okay.
Because I think if you look at the, like domain tasting was kind of a hybrid, because I do, you know, the work team that was created did actually specify a number of implementation, I would say 75% of the implementation for domain tasting came from the work team itself.
Right.
Whereas you have a number of other issues where, you know, maybe 10% or less is discussed by the work team about implementation. So in those instances, implementation was largely left to staff without any pre-involvement. So it really depends, I would think, on the amount of or the types of recommendations by the initial group to the, you know, into the process.
And I'm looking at this through maybe through the glasses of the new GTLD program, which has gone on now for, you know, a couple years, where, you know, staff could give a presentation or release an applicant guidebook version or something like that, and the council could see something in there and say, "Now wait a second," and you know, without staff coming to the council, you know, for reinterpretation or, you know, or re you know, review of or assessment of the implementation, I'm wondering, what would council's options be if they felt like the policy and the implementation were kind of, you know, starting to diverge?
Yeah. Marika, did you have a comment on this?
Yeah, this is Marika, because indeed it's to further, you know, go into the scenario that James is painting, because another question would be as well, like, what if, you know, what is the process for triggering a review by the council? If one councillor says, oh, well, I don't think this is, you know, how we intended it, like, what is the threshold that is required to actually, you know, if you indeed have a implementation review team on standby, you know, what is needed for them to get to work? Is that, you know, one constituency raising questions, one house raising questions? Would you need some kind of, you know, specifics around that, or is it just a normal vote that would need to be taken, for example? So those are some things that, you know, you might want to think about it as well.
Yeah, so so the question is, I guess, do we really want to fully define a complete process by which the council would get back together? I think that might be a little rigid. I mean, so when the staff decides something in general, there's a public comment period, so let's follow it through, okay? Let's take, now remember, the new GTLD process is not technically a PDP, but it's kind of outside that process, but let's assume it was, and so the question is, they come up with something, and then the council, the question, Marika, you said, is there a process by which the council would call a team together, and then the question is, would that even be binding, or would that even impact staff? That's a tough question. I mean, do we want to formally set up some mechanism to do that? Any thoughts on that? Is this something, is it too detailed? Is it something we really need to set up a process for? And if we set up a process, is it something that ICANN staff has to even listen to? James?
Yeah, and I don't mean to be overly prescriptive, and I don't think we should have necessarily a rigid or detailed process, but you know, I think it's good that we're thinking and discussing, think about these things and discussing them. I think that you know, ensuring that that in the general case, whether it's initiated by staff or it's initiated by counsel, just if the implementation of a policy is going to span you know, multiple meetings and in fact multiple counsels, you know, they should periodically get together and resynchronize you know, their intentions and their plans. And I don't know how to say that any more economically than I just did, but
right. Margie, you have a comment on this?
Yeah, I just had a question. Jeff, you said that the new GTLD process was not through a PDP, and I just wanted to get clarification on what you were talking about, because I thought the initial recommendation to allow new GTLDs came out of a PDP, but I may be wrong.
That's what I thought too, Margie. I was looking it up actually, but then I figured, well.
So it's kind of, yeah. So let me explain that a little bit. The initial process, which ended in 2007, was a policy development process. But I think what's kind of morphed out of it now, I mean, we could say that all the issues kind of stem from that initial PDP, but I don't think anyone would look at us seriously if we actually implied that. I think a lot of the issues now have not come out of the PDP or are very, very, very extremely loosely tied in some sort of way to that PDP. But I think what's going on now is staff is kind of creating implementation based on issues that have come up, a lot of them since the PDP. Right?
Right, Jeff, but I think that this is a perfect example where some, and not all, but some look at, you know, maybe a slice or two of those implementation decisions and say, wait a second, this is, you know, maybe an omission of the original policy, but this is something that shouldn't be decided, you know, on the ground, on the fly, during implementation. This needs to go back to the community for further discussion, you know.
Right. So we already said that if there are some policy issues or there's some questions, that should already go back to the council, that staff should be required to go back to the council. I guess what we're talking – so that's already in our notes.
Okay.
So what we're talking about now is where staff believes that there are no issues and they are – creating their implementation plan, and now all of a sudden the GNSO council says, wait a minute, staff, you got it wrong. You didn't come to us. There are issues that we see in it, and really staff is saying, no, we know we have to come to you if there are policy issues, but we don't think there are. So the question is now, is there a process by which the council could go in and somehow stop the staff, I guess, from finishing their implementation or implementing their implementation, and, you know, preempt that with a new process? I mean, someone tell me if you disagree with my interpretation, but that's because we've already made the recommendation that if there's any questions of policy, that should go to this, at least this implementation review team type process.
Right, and that's, I'm sorry, this is James speaking. That's the same process. It's just whether it's staff initiated or council initiated, right?
Yes, so we've already said that staff needs to initiate it if there's issues. Now the question we're grappling with is, should there be a process for council to initiate it if staff doesn't see that there's an issue or doesn't bring something to them, and council finds that there's an issue?
And this is Marika. To add something to that, and a bit triggered by what James said on, you know, of course councils will change and new people will get on the council. Of course, it should, you know, you should take into account as well that kind of procedure couldn't be gamed by councils that, you know, don't agree with the policy recommendations that were adopted maybe some time ago. So you avoid that, you know, they use that process to say, oh, well, you know, our predecessors adopted it, but we actually really don't like it. So we use this to basically stall it or change the implementation because it doesn't really fit with what we thought. You know, we think should be done. So that's something to, you know, another element to put into the equation.
Unless, of course, there are changing circumstances that would negate the need, right? So there could be something that was decided 2 years ago in a policy process, but that doesn't mean that if there's and I'm looking at what James put on as a comment. But, yeah, it doesn't mean that, you know, once it's decided that it can never be changed, because there could be circumstances that do change that would justify reopening.
But I guess as well, what kind of process do you need for that, and who, you know, who's the judge at the end of the day whether circumstances have changed or not? Because I guess it sometimes depends as well who's looking at it. So do you need, you know, I think we spoke about, you know, in some other section, I don't know, here on one of the other stages as well, like what kind of review do you build in once the policy is adopted to make sure that it's, you know, working as intended? So that might actually fit in there, because, of course, there you might have as well, depending on who you ask, they might think the situation has changed or not.
So I guess we could just update our recommendation to just say that if it's either council or staff that believes there are policy issues, that the council could then convene this implementation review team at its sole discretion to advise staff on the implementation. Because if we leave it pretty broad like that, instead of, my fear is getting too prescriptive and defining an exact process and putting another layer of bureaucracy to make staff run it by council and have this many days for comment, and, you know, because right now we've decided on the policy. In theory, it's something that the community really wants and or may really need, and implementation, speed of implementation could be an issue that's important. So perhaps we just leave it then as having this implementation review team that could either be called by staff or could be called by the council on its own to address any policy issues that it believes. And we can't really bind staff to it, but we can make the strong recommendation that staff seriously consider the input of the council on this. And in either case, the staff implementation report still needs to go to the board and I believe would still be subject to public comment. So do people feel like that's enough or that there's more that's needed? Margie, you have a comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to also point out that at least if you look at existing practice, a lot of times the implementation work is done under the supervision of the board because it came, you know, as part of the board approval of, say, the GNSO recommendation, it'll direct staff to do this. So I think we want to talk about how that plays into what staff is doing as a result of, you know, direction from the board, because there may be parallel processes going around, or, you know, and I think that's part of the problem we see in today in the implementation of the new GTLD program, is that there is a process. There's been public comment. There's, you know, it's under the supervision of the board, but yet I think the GNSO community seems like they feel like they want some additional, or, you know, this is what I'm hearing from you guys, an additional way of providing input in the implementation process.
Well, I think part of the problem is that the direction they're getting from the board may, in some circumstances, contradict or create new policy issues that were never addressed by the council. And so there's a view that since policy is supposed to be bottom-up as opposed to top-down, that at that point in time, the board should know that it cannot just unilaterally change the direction of implementation, and that if it does, it needs to go back to the bottom-up process. Because I think right now we have a board that is changing course too often and not going back through the bottom-up process simply because individuals on the board may have an idea of how they want to see things go. So perhaps that is a good idea to put in our report, as to say it's not just staff that, if there's any policy issues from staff, we should also say if there's any policy issues from the staff or recommendations from the board, it must go back through the council or this implementation team, and we should put a strong message to say that it's our recommendation that any policy that does not go through the bottom-up process should not be implemented.
I, I guess the question for you all is, I think there may be situations where there's not agreement among the, you know, if you were to try to get the consensus view of the council, for example, on implementation details, I think that's some of the frustration and difficulty that the board has, is that, you know, they're seeing issues that have complete, you know, divergence in approaches on how to deal with it. And you know, yet there's a recommendation to proceed with, you know, the policy recommendation of, you know, say, in launching new GTLDs as an example. So I think one of the things we have to think about, or the group needs to think about, is what type of vote, what type of consensus do you need, you know, to make recommendations out of this team, because that might very well be different than the initial consensus that was achieved to make the broad policy recommendation.
So I suppose that's if there's not agreement and there's no majority or supermajority recommendation from the council on something, that's totally different than if there is general agreement and then the board just decides to substitute its own thoughts on it. Right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, I think that's... I mean, I think that's right.
You know, but there are issues that come up. You know, for example, as much as people... We'll take the expressions of interest, right? I mean, that's something that was completely new that was introduced in the Seoul meeting. And, you know, even those that may ultimately support an EOI were not necessarily happy with the way it was handled, because it was basically the board met on that Thursday in Seoul, decided that on Friday it would proclaim that it would have an EOI or create recommendations for an EOI through some out-of-band process that didn't involve the GNSO community. Now, obviously, those that want an EOI process and want to move very quickly were okay with that. Others were not, and so that was completely an ad hoc thing by the board that probably should have been more bottom-up than it was. And so, you know, obviously, you see some comments. You see some comments to that in the comment form on EOI. So I think what we're saying, and let me go back to kind of just try to close the loop, what we're saying is that if there are any questions of policy or different ways in which something could be implemented, that needs to go back to our recommendations, that it goes back to the council or working group through some review team that the council or working group set up. Whether that comes from the staff itself, whether that comes from the board, or whether that is generated by the GNSO council on its own from, you know, reviewing what the staff has been doing, I think there should be this process to convene this team. Does anybody disagree with that notion? I mean, I think that's what I've been hearing. So I'm seeing some, at least Paul and James, our registrar guys, are agreeing with that. Let me ask the question. Does anyone disagree with that recommendation? Okay, so does anyone want to define that process anymore, or pretty much leave it to kind of as a general notion at this point, like we just discussed? Because I can't really see being too prescriptive of how to comprise that team, how to vote on the creation of that team. I just think that would be, at this point, we can get down a rat hole discussing that. James, you have a comment on that?
No, just to echo what you just said, Jeff, I think that there should be some team, and it should be convened to, you know, review those things, and whether it's staff-initiated, board-initiated, council-initiated, there's a couple of different methods by which it could be kicked off, and how that team governs itself and what comes out of it and who comprises it, I guess, should probably be decided, you know, situationally. But I think, you know, that – what you just said right there just encompasses everything I wanted to say for 6B and 6C.
Okay. And then in D, which is, can the implementation process change recommendations of the GNSO if deemed not implementable? If yes, what kind of process? I think that's subsumed in what we already said, that if there are policy issues and we could group in changes to recommendations because it's not implementable, I think it's the same process that we just discussed. It needs to go back to the council through some kind of review team to talk about it. A, whether even it's if there's one or two recommendations that are not implementable. I mean, we talked about on several occasions that the working group and the council could decide that they're presenting recommendations as a package as opposed to individual recommendations that someone could do kind of a line item veto with, you know, to pick and choose what they like. So if there are certain recommendations that the working group has deemed to be instrumental or deemed to be all part of the same package, that if there's any changes to that, whether it's because it's not implementable or because people change their mind, I think that all kind of is encompassed into this has to go back to the working group. And James had just asked a question, do we have an example of something not implementable? Staff, do you guys have any example that's come up before of something that's not implementable? Yeah, I could think of perhaps, you know, let's say that Liz has her hand raised. So, Liz, you have an example?
I don't have an example. I was going to make a different point.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, well, on that point, then just to close it out, there in theory could have been some intellectual property protections for new GTLDs that I know I had made strong points of things that were not implementable and you know, knock on wood, you know, people on the team, review teams, had actually, you know, thought about it some more and, you know, after lengthy discussions came to that agreement. But I could have foreseen situations where certain groups would want certain things that may not be implementable, keeping in mind, I know that keeping in mind what the goals were. So I don't know if we have a specific example, James, at this point of something that wasn't implementable, but there certainly could have been.
Hey, Jeff, I have an example from the trademark world in the discussions of, you know, IRT, STI. At some point, there was a suggestion made that perhaps you pre-clear, you know, every registration against the Trademark Clearinghouse. I think, you know, obviously that didn't become a recommendation, but I think that's one of the things that, you know, was viewed as unimplementable.
Right, it was viewed as non-implementable if we wanted to keep the notion of a real-time registration system. Yeah, and so yeah, that's actually one, Margie, that I was thinking about that didn't ultimately make it through, but it conceivably it could have.
Right.
Okay, so Liz, you have a comment?
Actually, I have two. One has to do with the instances in which this might arise. And, for example, we talked about new concerns that might come up. We talked about something being not implementable. We talked about, you know, just basically changing your mind about something. I think there also may be a fourth scenario that Marika touched on where there was no agreement to begin with and where, in a sense, the group punted to implementation. And the occasion when that comes to my mind is in the case of domain tasting, when the group was negotiating the final resolution language and was trying to decide whether to define extraordinary circumstances and, you know, the exception that should apply. And essentially, I think, at least my take on that was that they couldn't reach agreement, so they kind of left it to implementation. So, you know, that was a conscious decision in a sense, because they couldn't reach agreement. You wouldn't want a situation like that to delay implementation, to reopen a debate that they could have solved if they wanted to at the time. So in that case, I think, you know, that might be an instance when it's not appropriate to send it back to the council. And then the other thing I want to raise is just asking the group, are you saying that implementation should stop while this process occurs? It would be my view that the implementation shouldn't stop while this process occurs. but I think you should be clear on what you are intending as you formulate or flesh out this idea.
So let's take that latter question first. When you say implementation shouldn't stop, I don't think, was implementation actually moving at that point in time? In other words, staff is charged with coming up with an implementation plan, and then it goes to the board. But there's been no actual physical implementation of anything until after the implementation plan is put out for comment.
I think it depends on the issue, right? And it depends on the implementation. Nuge Utilities was certainly a special case where they've continued to solicit community views throughout an extraordinarily long implementation process, as distinct from, say, domain tasting, to a much smaller effort.
Yeah.
I just think you want to avoid, you know, you want to at least be conscious about what are you saying happens while this group does its thing. What do you think? What does the group think? Rather than, you know, leave my opinion aside, what does the group think should happen with implementation work? Like in the case of Nuge Utilities, where issues have arisen during the implementation. I mean, you make a very good point. If the implementation hasn't begun yet and we're just at public comments, then that's the point where, you know, lots of opportunity for feedback there.
Yeah, and I'll go to James. It would definitely be issue specific and may only apply to a specific issue within the overall PDP. But in certain, you know, I'm not sure we can create a blanket rule to say implementation shouldn't stop, because I think in certain circumstances, where there are policy issues or the staff or board are directing action that's inconsistent with what the GNSO Council has advised, then it probably should stop. But I can see situations that you've mentioned where it shouldn't. So, James, do you have a comment?
No, just wanted to echo your last point there, Jeff. You know, it really depends on what the harm is that the policy is seeking to correct. You know, if the harm is something like tasting, well, then you want implementation to continue. But if the perceived harm is, you know, introducing new TLDs might harm somebody in the incumbents, then maybe they feel like it should wait until that issue is settled. So I don't think you can tell in advance. I think it needs to be decided by that group.
Alex?
My thinking is that sometimes, I'm echoing again what James said and looking for a middle ground with what had been said earlier, is that sometimes you may want to give staff an opportunity to carry on, but in the interim, as a decision is being made, perhaps where the instances were deadlock, or maybe decisions or consensus have not been arrived at, but any sort of agreement that may be entered into is on the understanding that it was an interim measure, not something that should be taken as a precedent. And whoever is involved may be advised in advance to be aware of that situation, because certain situation you may just have to carry on, like example cited. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, I think that's – so it sounds like everyone here is being consistent on the notion that, to answer Liz's question about at least the second one, which is whether to stop implementation or not, I think that's – kind of an issue by issue. It's not one we could generalize on, but certainly, so the answer is yes, it may in some cases, and no, it may not in other cases, but I think it's the council that should review that, and that should be part of their review process, is to basically, when it creates the team, is to recommend that the process stop or recommend that the process continue in certain facets, but not with respect to that one particular issue. So, for example, in new TLDs, they could have said, you know, look, this intellectual property issue is still a big issue. We want to take another look at it, but that shouldn't stop you from resolving issues about community and public immorality and other things that were in the new TLD process, but it should stop you from moving forward with specific mechanisms on IP. I mean, that's just a made-up example. On the first point about where there's no agreement and the council looks to the board to resolve it, should there still be a committee, my gut reaction is I think if the council wants to create a committee on it, I think yes, because I think – let me give an example of where there's bitter disagreement now with certain groups. Let's say vertical integration, right? So there's disagreement between, you know, there's the one camp that says that there should be no integration, it should be as it exists today, and, you know, anything else we shouldn't do. There's another camp that says, no, we should allow integration because it's more efficient and, you know, all of those reasons. If the boards or the staff are making the determination, at least for the new round, to say, yes, we're going to allow integration, I think the camp that doesn't want integration would still want to have a say. If integration is going to happen, it would still want to have a say in how that integration happens. It may not be able to reopen the complete policy debate, but I think that there are some implementation issues that once you resolve, are we going to do it or not, that should go out for implementation review team. Does that make any sense? Anybody? So James and Paul, you have a question or a comment?
Yeah, Jeff. I mean, I see your point there, and just for the, you know, for the record, we're staying out of that vertical integration. You know.
Yeah, I was just trying to.
And I understand it was a hypothetical, but I just wanted to. But you know, I mean, if there's a, let's say there's a decision on policy X, and there's a minority, you know, a strong, vocal, and organized minority, I'm concerned that the process you just described could be used to, you know, death by a thousand cuts of the whatever policy actually came out of it, where it could just continuously be used to undermine the original intention, or, and maybe that's the, you know, conspiratorial perspective. I think the practical perspective is that they can continue to address smaller and smaller aspects of the issue indefinitely and delay, you know, forestall implementation altogether. So, you know, I mean, I agree with what you're saying in principle, but I think that I haven't been around ICANN that long, just since the LA meeting, but I'm concerned that how that might actually be put into practice.
Okay. Paul?
Yeah, I thought it was a good example that you used, Jeff, and recognize it's just an example. It's fine. But I would just question anything that, to follow it through, anything that staff might say, okay, this is the way we're going to move forward, there will still be a public comment period, right? I mean, isn't there always built in still an opportunity for all sides to have a say? It's not like it's just they're going to say, here's a plan, and boom, it happens right away. Am I mistaken there? I guess it's an open question for staff to help. There's always another comment period, so, you know, the reality of the process, that there will be additional opportunities to try and influence and the overall process. Is that correct?
So, in general, I think there are comment periods, but I'm not sure that you never know what the result of a comment period is going to be. And I think policy issues can be raised by so let me use vertical integration as an example. And so just because it's one that's near and dear. And so let's say the ICANN staff says, look, you know, it's going to release its paper. It says we're going to go forward with vertical integration, but we're only going to do it for new GTLDs, and we're not going to do it for existing registries. Okay? Let's say that that's a proclamation, or it doesn't address existing registries. So it may not say it's not going to apply to existing registries. It's just going to say for new TLDs we'll allow integration going forward. At that point in time, I think there are a number of policy issues that are raised that are very different from the policy issues initially raised in the debate as to whether there should be integration or not. Right? So I know from a registry stakeholder group perspective, that would be something that the registry stakeholder group would not want to just be subject to a public comment period without further analysis done. Or alternative, you know, like, so that's an issue where I think it could be decided. Or let's go to a different issue. Let's say an intellectual property issue that says, let's say there was a debate as to whether there should be a required sunrise period for every new TLD or not. And let's say the board decides and the community decides to recommend or can't come to an agreement, so the board decides, yes, every new TLD will have a sunrise period. But that's the once that recommendation is made, there are 20 different ways a sunrise period could be done. And so I think though that part you would have to be sent to the council to say, look, the recommendation is that there will be a sunrise period. Now I need you all to come to agreement on the best way to do that or to make recommendations on how to do that. I just think that leaving that completely to staff and an individual public comment period may not suffice for a number of different groups. James, you have a comment?
Yeah, just real quickly, Jeff. I just wanted to put out there that if the policy had that many and that large of holes or omissions in it, then I would say that the working group that sent it to council probably dropped the ball. Just my initial take. I mean, I understand what you're saying, and I agree with you for the most part. But I didn't point to that as a failure of the policy or the implementation between staff and council. I think that really goes back to the working group.
I'm not sure it's a failure or not, right? Because if you look at the IRT report and you look at the STI report, they recommended, they said that there should be a sunrise or IP claim process, and there were some guidance given on IP claims. Not so much, the IRT recommended a standard sunrise process, but I wouldn't say that the community or the policy process really focused on the actual mechanisms. And I wouldn't say it's necessarily a failing of the group. It could be because of a lack of time. It could be because, the main overall issue wasn't decided. And I think there could still be – I guess my point is if you go back to the four scenarios that Liz had mentioned about convening an implementation team, we said if there's new concerns that come up that weren't addressed, we all agreed that an implementation recommendation team should be created by the council to address those new concerns. We all said that if something's not implementable, then that should go back to the review team to see whether, if one or more parts are not implementable, whether the whole thing is worth pursuing or not. Yeah, that should go back to the review team. We all kind of addressed and agreed that if there's a changing of the mind, so the board or staff changes its mind about the recommendation or puts it something a recommendation that's conflicting, we all agreed that that should go back to the implementation recommendation team. The question now is on the fourth category of if there was no agreement in the first place, should issues of policy that are decided by the staff or board go back to the council? And I guess I'm not sure why we would treat that category as different than the others, and giving the council the discretion to create that implementation team if it decides it needs it. Or you guys let me know if you disagree. Do you think that fourth one is so different from the three other examples that it should be treated differently? James?
Yeah, I'm just going to restate that I think we can wind all of these up into the idea that there is an implementation review that can be staff-initiated, board-initiated, or council-initiated, and not be overly prescriptive in what they can and can't do or what has to come out of that. Just get the, three legs of the stools together to get over these obstacles during implementation.
Yeah, I think that sounds.
Because I mean, even for the things that are quote unquote not implementable, I mean, maybe council has a different idea. I don't know. Maybe it can be slightly modified to remove those concerns. I don't know. It's really hard to think of all the scenarios that this would have to be built for. So I think it just keeping it as general as possible would make it as useful as possible.
Yeah, it sounds like I know Paul had put a check mark, and Alex agrees. I think that sounds right. I think in the general tone of not getting overly prescriptive, we could say exactly what you did, James, and use these four categories as different examples as to when the council may call this review team together. All right. Any other comments on question six in general? Great. I'd like to actually start on, we're going to skip over the timing because that's an overarching issue, number seven, which I think we'll get into after we talk about stage five. So, Marika, you have a comment?
Yeah, it is, Marika, but before we switch to the other document, just one comment that I posted as well in the chat that I got confirmation that the GAC is very likely to discuss new GTLDs on Sunday afternoon, probably from 2 o'clock or maybe a little bit earlier onwards. So in order to not give Glenn so much work, do you want to just focus then on the morning session for the PDP work team, or you want to still keep both slots?
Yeah, let's focus in on the morning, and if we need something in the afternoon, it may be for the full PPSC, but I'll talk to you guys after about that.
Okay, so we'll just leave it for now on the two slots then.
Well, the PDP team, just in the morning one.
Okay.
This team.
Yeah,
I need to follow up with you and Jay Scott to see what, if anything, is expected out of the working group work team. Will it by that point have been referred to the steering committee or
no? No, not yet.
Okay, then they're
going for public comment tomorrow.
Okay. All right, so then at this point we don't need to hold anything for the PPSC. If we need an impromptu meeting, actually I'm not even sure Jay Scott's going to be there.
No, I don't think so.
No, he wasn't planning to.
Okay, so then we'll just need the morning.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Marika.
Okay, so now we're changing a little bit, changing gears. The policy development process has been completed. It's been implemented. It's been in place for a certain period of time. And stage five deals with, and we talked a little bit about this on the last call when we were creating the questions behind the survey. So some of this will probably ring a bell. But there, stage five is broken down into two different parts, really. The first part being about an individual PDP, reviewing the implementation or assessing an individual PDP, and then the second part is assessing the overall PDP process, kind of like what we're doing now, but on a periodic basis. So keeping that in mind, the first question deals with the assessment of an individual PDP, question one, all deals with the assessment of specific recommendations within a specific PDP. And I believe question two also is with a specific, question two also deals with the specific PDP, and question three is on the overall PDP process. Does that make sense? I kind of feel like sometimes I'm talking around in a circle here. All right. So with the first question, the question is, and this was asked on the survey, and so perhaps you've already answered some of these, but the question is on what metrics would we need to develop in order to assess the effectiveness of the PDP recommendations and or policy. Now, I will preface this question with there have been a number of PDPs in the recent history of ICANN as opposed to the past history that have actually set in metrics or may not have set metrics but have set in a process to review. So, for example, the domain tasting, although we haven't convened this group, I'm not sure if we have, but they did say that within 12 months of the implementation that there would be a group that got back together to assess whether it has been effective or not. I think that's been preempted a little bit by staff's reports to the council that have said that, yes, we think it's been effective, and here's the statistics that we have. And there, because of that, there probably has not been deemed to be a need to create a group to look at this. But I'm not sure with other issues in the future that may not be the case. I know that the STI group for the trademark recommendations also recommended that there should be periodic reviews of the UDRP, not the UDRP, but the someone help me with the acronym now. Essentially the faster track UDRP. The faster track UDRP, that there should be a review period, at least it recommended to the board. Yes, the URF. Thank you, James. Gosh, it's already been a long day. With the URS, the STI team had made, the recommendation that there be a review after 6 months or a year. So I've definitely noticed a trend in work groups to create that review period inherently in there. So do we think this is a good practice? Do we think this should be kind of a recommendation to their working group to put that into their report? Or, James, you have a comment on it?
Yeah, Jeff, thank you. This is James speaking. And I responded to the survey, and so I'm going to paraphrase from my response and try to be as specific as possible and also qualify by saying that this is probably one of the biggest issues that got me involved in PPSC PDP working group to begin with. I'm involved in a number of PDPs right now that are ongoing, and I'm not going to name names, but there's a couple of them where, you know, I think members of the working group have specifically asked, you know, how do we quantify the harm, you know, that's occurring? What problem is it that we're trying to solve, and how can we describe it, you know, objectively? And, you know, the one group in particular has just said, well, we can't do that right now, but let's charge forward with the PDP. And I think the problem is, if you can't define or quantify the problem, then you can't determine whether or not the PDP was successful. You know, you're creating policy in a vacuum. So I think, and I think I put this down here as part of my recommendation for, I think it was 1H, about what role the working group should have in proposing or in developing the performance metrics. I think that's critical. I think that the working group has to be able to define the problem, because that way, that is the only way they can define whether or not the policy that they're creating is successful. And if they can't define the problem, then honestly, I think that we really need to look at you know, why the PDP exists. So, you know, there's my comment on this particular section. So, and I think that roughly, hopefully, you know, consistency is something I'm not known for. So hopefully that, you know, pretty much aligns with what I responded to in the survey.
So would you, another way of saying it is that the working group should basically say, you know, if we were to look back on this problem in a year or two, how would we all look at ourselves and say, yes, what we did was a success?
That's exactly right, Jeff. And that is something that, you know, a lot of organizations, including, you know, the company that I work for, is very, you know, that's the standard they hold us to. You've got an idea, you've got a proposal, you've got a new product, whatever. How are you going to know when you've reached a successful outcome? Because if you can't answer that question, then I don't think you've really put enough thought in the front end on what the problem is you're setting out to solve.
So just to drill down, and then I'll get to Marika and Alex. You believe that that should be a required element in the working group report to the council?
Yeah, I think, you know, while we're on the subject of success metrics, I'm kind of working backwards at it, but yes, you're correct. The success metrics have to be coming from the working group, and in order for the working group to develop success metrics, they have to be able to quantify the problem. So it's kind of this dependency chain going back from what they're handing to the council versus, you know, somewhat is driven by what they, what work they should be doing beforehand. So it's just something I think that it's going to make more effective policy, in my opinion.
Okay, let me go to Alex, and then I'll go to Marika.
My opinion is that we could borrow from the model of the law. Why these laws are passed is to correct certain mischiefs. So we got to have a problem first and then the policy would be like the equivalent of the law, which is trying to correct that problem. We could envisage that in the future, maybe after introduction of new policies, but at least there must be some reason for the existence of the policy. So in a way, I'm actually backing up what James has just said. There must be a reason why each PDP was initiated, and that should be known, and it should therefore be embedded, and creating room also for anything new that may arise. You have given some sample examples of new things that may have not been considered for various reasons. But I do believe there must be a minimum set of reasons that can be used as a basis of metrics of considering whether the objective of that particular PDP is being met. Thanks.
Okay, good. So it sounds like you, James, Paul, are in agreement, Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. I just wanted to add, because I think it's something we already discussed before, that quantifying the issue and identifying the problem is actually something that should be done before the working group is created, and actually should take place at the initiation of the process, the issues report, the request for the issues report, and the council consideration of that. I don't think, of course, a working group can further quantify what the actual issue is that they're addressing, but the debate shouldn't focus about what is actually the problem, because that process should have taken place beforehand. And I agree, we're not very good at doing that now, and hopefully this new process will help in getting that at the front end of the process, so that working groups can actually focus, like, okay, this is what we're actually trying to address, and here are some metrics indeed that we believe might help to quantify at the end of the day whether we've been successful in addressing the problem.
Does anyone disagree with the notion that this should be a required element in the working group report? Or let me ask it a different way. Can anyone foresee a situation where this wouldn't be included in a working group report or shouldn't be included? It sounds like we're all in agreement with this notion that it should be a required element of the working group report, that if the problem hasn't been adequately defined, that they should adequately define and quantify it, and then they should also have a section of the report devoted to if there's a review done in a certain period of time, and we'll leave the question of how much time should be left to assess the success. Putting that issue aside, there should be, after some period of time, a way to go back and objectively measure whether the results indicate that there's been a success. So James, you have a comment?
Yeah, Jeff, just real quickly, I never say never, never say always. So I suppose it's possible there could be a PDP on a binary issue that is that it doesn't open itself or the problem to quantification beyond, true-false. Maybe in that case, it wouldn't make sense to go to the lengths of quantifying the problem, quantifying the success, if it's just a yes-no, on-off, up-or-down type of an issue. But in all other cases, I think that you're correct.
Okay. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. My question would be, because I think we spoke in one of the previous stages, like the bylaws prescribe certain elements that, for example, the issues report needs to have, and as well which information needs to be gathered in the working group report, like constituency statements and public comments. Is this something as well that should be recommended there, or is this, again, one of the elements that we would like to see more in a, PDP guidelines document saying, well, we would really strongly encourage working groups to include, guidance on how to review the policy or what is required to effectively assess the effectiveness of a policy down the road? What are the views there?
So if I could, I'll jump in. This is Jeff. It sounded like to me that people were saying that this should be a pretty hard requirement, is to measure the success. Even if there's not a binary yes or no answer, it sounds like this is this is as important as as defining the problem, and therefore it sounds like this group is recommending to be a hard requirement in the bylaws. But people, James, Alex, you guys, let me know if you disagree, but James, it sounded like a pretty passionate issue for you.
I don't know how to respond to that.
Well, I mean, do you think it should be something that's a hard requirement in the bylaws, or do you think it should be something that's more kind of in the operational rules? You know, they should, a working group should do this, but not really required.
I guess I hadn't thought of where it goes, Jeff. I really think that if you can't in a working group, if you can't define a problem that you're setting out to solve, then that, to me, becomes an existential challenge to the working group itself.
Is it possible to define a problem but not necessarily be able to assess what success would be?
Not if it's properly defined, in my opinion.
Okay.
Because if you can identify a problem and you can quantify it, then I think that, you know, whether it's statistically or mathematically or just, you know, if even in a binary case of whether it exists or not, if you've identified a problem or a harm, then you should be able to measure when you've successfully mitigated that harm. You know, not perfectly, but made a dent. You know, I'm sure that there's still some examples of tasting going on, for example, but a 90%+ reduction in the incidence, I think, is a pretty good success metric.
Well, let me give you a different type of example, although it may not be quantifiable, but it's certainly measurable. So 2 years ago, maybe it was last, no, it was 2 years ago, that a flaw, Kaminsky found a flaw in DNS, that it was possible to have a man-in-the-middle attack to break certain protocols in DNS to actually compromise DNS and have messages inserted and queries going to places that it was never intended to go, and the sender or recipient would never, or sorry, the sender of the query would never know that it was going to the wrong place, right? And that's what DNSSEC, it's one of the things that DNSSEC is there to solve. He discovered the flaw, but there had been really no record of those attacks actually taking place. But he had discovered it, and he was able to do it and say, theoretically, this is and can be a real problem. But it had never been done. It really had never been done before that someone had actually done this type of man-in-the-middle attack. So the problem couldn't be quantified in the sense of, look, it's never really been done before, but we know that people are going to be as smart as I am. They're going to be able to do it. And if they do it, you know, it could be millions and millions of dollars, or, you know, billions of dollars, and all sorts of fraud and all sorts of things, bad things will happen.
Well, then Jeff, and this is James speaking, then your problem definition becomes the number of unpatched or vulnerable DNS resolvers in the field. Your success metrics would be how quickly you can release the patches for the various DNS systems and how quickly they're adopted by the operators.
Right. So the harm was not quantifiable, but you were able to quantify define the problem and then come up with a measure of success.
Well, yeah, and in this case, the harm was a vulnerability, and you want to close that. I don't think we'll ever eliminate that vulnerability, but you want to close the window of vulnerability. So I think you can still define and measure that, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Paul?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. We've gotten a bit away from the point I was originally going to make, but I'll just reiterate what James and yourself have both said about the importance of some effort to quantify. It's just critical in the problem definition at the beginning to have something that we can consider a metric to look at during the working group deliberations, and then down the road to try and assess, you know, the success or failure of whatever recommendations policy we've come up with. Unlike James, I'm perfectly happy to call a spade, and to use an example that we had, the Fast Flux Working Group was probably the definition of how not to do a PDP. The issues report said more work needs to be done. A particular counselor had a bug up his butt about getting this done, managed to get it through with the barest minimum voting threshold. Everybody recognized there was no data. It was very difficult to keep track of, to quantify, et cetera. We spent well over a year going around in circles and circles. What we ultimately put out was our best effort, but it didn't move us anywhere in actually dealing with the issue. I mean, it's sort of like a classic failure of, you know, not defining, not setting up, not doing any of the things that were suggested by the experts that staff had spoken to in creating the issues report. You know, the council, just particular counselors, just decided they wanted this done. Something, in quotations, something had to be done. And you know, the community suffers because there are so many requests for our time to assist in these various policy initiatives. And, you know, that one, and there are several that are ongoing right now where, you know, you ask them, well, demonstrate the harm. We can't. We know it's happening, but we don't have any data. Now, in fairness to staff, you know, we know in particular compliance staff has been very frank in saying when they have data, when they don't. In cases where they don't, they're making specific requests that a number of us are supporting for the resources necessary to build databases so that these questions that come up, they will have something to, you know, we can really sink our teeth into in the future. But, you know, for our purposes here as part of this particular group, so very important that this is something that really needs to be pushed hard. And honestly, council needs to, you know, whether it's in bylaws or the operational rules, but it needs to be pretty clear so that we don't get these situations where a very small number of counselors can basically game the system, get their pet projects initiated, and then we're all stuck spinning our wheels for a very long period of time with very little to show for it when it's all said and done.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. Alex?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff, for reminding us on that Kaminsky example. What that goes to show is that this, we may want to actually embed and require that the parameters for the problem being solved that have been identified at the issues report and before the PDP are actually used, and the success rate based on the maximum number of parameters. But going back to that example you gave, we should also be cognizant that there are new challenges that will come that may have been overlooked at the PDP stage and in the parameters that were developed. There are new possibilities that may not have existed then, or reactions in the market that sometimes may result in the opposite of the intended market reaction or effect. So it's in those cases that maybe we may want to have some room for extra parameters that can be used or can be incorporated or provided for, so that we don't lock out new issues that may arise. For example, that of Kaminsky took so long. Is it also a question that maybe the community didn't take it seriously, or what was wrong with the system that they could not be responded to, the challenges they posed, not after they demonstrated it, because they had said they had tried demonstrating that for a long time and they couldn't get audience. Is it a problem with the system of the community? You know, this is just a question I'm posing a bit out of this, but somehow related to trying to have some room also open as we create parameters for all future parameters to measure the success rate. Thanks.
Right, and I think that's important. I think a lot of things can change, especially your point about market conditions or things in the market could address the problems that were not anticipated by the working group. But you know, I think again that could certainly be assessed on after, you know. However, one of the questions in the future is going to go to who assesses it. So we haven't gotten there yet, but whoever that does that should certainly be looking at externalities and not just the things that the initial working group was looking at. Let me go to Margie and Marika. I don't know which one of you was first. I apologize, but you're
I think
both
Margie was first.
Okay, Margie.
It's back to the prior topic about information and assessment of the problem. And I think the Kaminsky example you gave was a good one. I can think of another that we're going to be seeing shortly. For example, the vertical separation discussion that we will be starting in a PDP, there's a lot of, you know, concern about potential problems that might happen if, for example, if there was no longer separation. I think, you know, those are valid things to look at, but we might be faced with that very situation where you don't have information on what the problems are because the problem hasn't happened yet. And so a lot of the work on the policy front is going to be, you know, evaluating that, and I wouldn't want to foreclose a policy development merely because we don't have statistics, because it's essentially a future problem. And so I just want to caution us not to make it too stringent of a requirement. I think it's a good thing to put it as something that should be thought out where available, because it certainly, you know, is an important factor of the policy development process. But I just wouldn't want to make it, you know, that you can't have policy if you don't have statistics, something that onerous, because I think there will be lots of examples where that might come into play and where the council would feel that it is appropriate to develop policy.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. I'm not sure, and Paul and James have raised their hands, so I'll let them address it. But I'm not sure anyone was saying there has to be statistics, but just has to be a quantifiable problem. And maybe in the vertical integration, the quantifiable or the problem is that in other industries, when there is vertical integration, certain things could happen. And a measure of success would be that those things that happened in other industries didn't happen because of certain measures that were put into place. And that could so you don't necessarily need statistics. I agree with you on that. But let me turn it over to Paul and then James.
I was still in the queue, too.
Yeah, I don't want to cut you off, Margie. Go ahead.
Because similar point to Margie's.
Is it different or the same?
It's a similar one. So.
Okay.
So then Paul and James can react to that, because as well, it's, you know, it's about the question of like how do you quantify or assess harm, and as well making a point there, because some people raised, for example, post-expiration domain name recovery working group. Yes, we don't have hard statistics or, you know, we only have anecdotal stories of people losing their domain names, but at the same time, it's obvious from some of the research we've done that there's, you know, lack of transparency and understanding, you know, those are elements as well that, you know, are in the interest of the broader internet community to have transparency and predictability. So those are difficult things to assess as harm, just maybe things that can be better. So, you know, there on the point of Margie, you might not always have statistics or data that you know, warrant the initiation of a PDP, but there might be other elements that come into play in making that decision, and that's indeed where the council needs to make that assessment. And they, I think, should be providing as well the working group with that information as to why they felt this required a PDP that will help as well the working group to understand and then quantify indeed, okay, so what are the, you know, measures for success? How do we make sure that we address the issue that the council saw that needs to be addressed here?
Okay. I think that's a good point, Paul and James.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. Both Margie and Marika make excellent points and agree with most of what they said. And wanted to make it clear for the record that I'm not didn't mean to imply that a PDP should not go forward if we don't have the data. What really bothers me is when staff in compiling the issues report, talking to experts and whatnot, very clearly identifies problems, whether they're questions of scope, questions of data, difficulty in kind of wrapping our heads around the problem, and yet the PDP is launched anyway. Because somebody has a particular agenda, when we recognize it at the issues report level, right up front at the beginning, that the particular policy question is not ripe for a PDP yet, that some more research needs to be done and whatnot, I think it's very important, almost incumbent on council to take that recommendation very seriously, to do whatever is necessary to seek out, to begin to do the background spade work, so that, you know, when the formal PDP is launched, we are not, you know, wasting our time either trying to build these databases or kind of looking around for something more than a few anecdotal examples that we would have heeded the staff's and the experts' initial warnings, recommendations to do that stuff beforehand.
Okay. All right. James?
Yeah, Jeff, I imagine you're getting tired of hearing from me today. So, but this section particularly is something I'm keenly interested in. So first I wanted to say I agree with a lot of what Paul just said, so I wanted to lend my support there. And I just wanted to address Margie's point earlier about, you know, some problems cannot, you know, don't lend themselves well to being quantified, or they are not necessarily identified problems, but identifiably potential problems. And so therefore it's hard to quantify whether or not, you know, they're hypothetically could be a problem. I think that, you know, picking on the vertical separation issue, I mean, there's an interesting case because you have competing hypothetical harms, right? I mean, neither side of that issue has, I think, quantified or demonstrated the harm that is occurring now or, you know, in the absence of that policy. So I think that's an interesting point. But I think that it's still it still lends itself, and it's a good exercise to demonstrate or to you know, to do as due diligence as far as putting together a definition and substantiation. Maybe that's a better word than quantify, substantiation of the problem. And I think that better policy will be the result. And this kind of segues into what Marika was saying about post expiry. We can always make processes better, but for example, if we required a certain notice, let's say, to go out via email, since we don't really have a quantifiable data set to back up the, you know, to back up the problem, we don't know if that's actually going to have an impact or not. You know, at GoDaddy, for example, we've tried a lot of things to prevent inadvertent loss of names. We tried, you know, sending out messages in 24-point purple font, you know, and sometimes they just they still occur. And we don't know what an acceptable rate of or a natural rate of this incident would be because we can't quantify the problem. So I would submit that because we can't quantify the problem, that doesn't necessarily mean the PDP has to be stopped dead in its tracks, but we have to recognize that whatever policy is going to come out of that is also going to be a little gray and a little fuzzy and a little difficult to measure whether or not it was effective at all. And I think that the policy that results from that process, in and of itself, the policy will be flawed. So, you know, I just kind of wanted to touch on those things. I think they're good points, Margie, Marika, and I certainly don't want to seem like I'm coming down the opposite side of what you're saying, but I just think that there's a, you know, we should never turn away from doing everything we can to, you know, put some boundaries around the problem. Because, you know, in the case of Pedner, for example, we don't know if what we do has a positive or negative impact, you know, the same way I don't know if the color tie I wore today is going to affect the weather. The causality starts to fall down. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. And for the record, the purple font worked with me.
It did?
I'm just kidding.
I have one now that has a bright red blinking, like fire engine red banner that says your domain is expiring. It is so annoyingly bright and conspicuous, and I got one the other day, and I almost had to dim my screen. It was hurting my eyes. So,
okay. Liz?
Thanks. I don't know if this helps or not, but I just I think some of what you're talking about really goes back to why we all had that very robust discussion about pre-PDP scoping and the notion that on some of these nebulous areas where you're trying to define or measure the degree to which something is a problem before embarking on a full-scale assault, why that pre-PDP scoping effort is so important. And the thought that I have is to encourage you to consider whether voting thresholds should be changed in terms of initiating a PDP, initiating a PDP that perhaps staff recommended against suing, should there be a higher threshold for that? I think we haven't talked about thresholds in this group because the thresholds were just changed in a careful negotiation that, you know, affected the restructuring and that was essential for the restructuring. But I don't think it's out of bounds for this group to reconsider thresholds because of the issues that you're describing now, and to perhaps give more teeth to these concerns through modifications to thresholds, voting thresholds.
So that is an interesting idea. I'm not sure at this point. I think, well, first of all, we would need a lot of other groups on the call, since we seem to be mostly represented here by the contracted parties. I would like to, because that could take us down a huge rat hole for a long period of time, I'd like to put that one aside and possibly do that towards the end of the whole process to kind of look back and as we look at everything and say, okay, are these the right thresholds? But I think if we do it now, and others can weigh in, I think it's going to not that I disagree or with your notion.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't naive, I think, in raising it. I understand it's controversial and difficult and that, you know, it may be something you do at the end. But what I don't want is to for this group to be so, in a sense, intimidated by it that, you know, there could be changes that really need to get made there or that would translate some of your concerns. And I understand that this isn't a diverse group on the call today either. So I just want to throw it out there. And, Jeff, whatever you recommend about timing is great. I know what that would entail, but I think it's important not to ignore it in light of this discussion.
Right. Okay. So with that, it's now we're an hour and a half in, so we're at the end of the call. I think that was good. I'm going to send out an attendance sheet to all the constituencies again, or stakeholder groups and constituencies, to hopefully make a plea to get more people to attend these calls so that we can have more of the – I mean, we're making very good progress. The fear I have is that we're making really good progress and we're moving faster, that all of a sudden the people that haven't been here for a few weeks are all of a sudden going to see these, you know, reports and things that they may be taking us backwards by making comments on those. So with that said, please complete the survey if you haven't done so already, and which is it might just be me because I think everyone else on this call actually did it. Also, then we still have stages 1, 2, and 3 of the report out there, so that we can get some last comments on that and redo those so we can have another version that goes out soon. And I look forward to talking to you all next week.
Great, thank you, Jeff.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, Jeff. Have a good one.
You too. Bye.